advisement. We will go on to the second case of the day, which is 03-14-57, and it's Charles M. McDonald versus the Village of Winnetka. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a class of one equal protection case under Village of Willowbrook versus Olick. To establish that kind of a claim, there are two elements: differential treatment and the lack of a rational basis, or alternatively, an illegitimate animus. I'd like to talk about the differential treatment element first. To establish that element, a plaintiff has to show that he has been treated differently than others who were similarly situated. Now, to prove that, the plaintiff does not have to show that he was identical to other persons. What he has to show is that he stood in the same relation to the government action at issue as the other persons.
What is Mr. McDonald's underlying injury here? Is it the stigma that was caused by the investigation?
Well, Your Honor, I think the underlying injury, and this Court made this clear in the Sherwin Manor case that we cite in our reply brief and others, the underlying injury in an equal protection case is the differential treatment. It is being denied the equal protection. Now, if you're asking what are his damages, I think there's certainly the stigma, there's the expense that he had to go through to deal with the unfounded charges.
So in your view, does one have a viable class of one claim every time the government conducts an investigation and departs from investigative norms in some way, even if the investigation results in no formal action against a plaintiff?
Let me state it a little bit differently. I think that there is a class of one equal protection claim when it's been established that the government, whether you call it investigative standards or something else, that the government treats everybody in this position the same, except for the plaintiff.
I don't see where you have any proof of that.
Well, here's the proof here.
Seems to me you got to show that some other case where the evidence of the non-arson cause was a similar or lesser weight, and the evidence of arson was a similar or greater weight, and nonetheless, the defendants didn't deem the fire to be caused by arson and didn't refer it to the ATF.
I don't think we have to
go through that process.
No, I don't think we do, Your Honor, and here's why. In this case, the district...
You've got these other cases, and you say the fire department said they followed their normal procedure in the other cases. Of course, the same thing applies to this case. The fire department says, yeah, we've followed our normal procedure. You're taking exception to that.
Right. That's correct.
But I don't see where you've got any similarly situated situation that you can compare with this case.
Well, here's how we get there, Your Honor. First of all, as Your Honor pointed out, there is evidence in the record, and it's cited and it's discussed in our supplemental appendix, pages 14 through 16, of specific prior cases where these standards were applied. But more importantly...
What standards were applied? You just got some general statement that, you know, they eliminated the non-arson causes, and therefore they said it was arson.
Well, there are two prongs to the standard that they apply.
You've got to show a case where they said it wasn't arson.
I don't think we do, Your Honor.
Well, that would prove this case was different, because they say it was arson.
Well, Your Honor, here's the situation. The defendant admitted that in every fire investigation they proceeded in the same fashion. Before declaring a fire an arson, they first would eliminate all possible accidental causes, and second, they would have to find affirmative proof that the fire was deliberately set. Now, that was admitted, and the district court at page 22 of the appendix noted that they said that that's what we do in every case.
But do these norms confine investigators while the investigation is still underway? If the investigators come across some clue that the fire may have been caused by arson, can't they pursue that line of investigation at the same time as they are pursuing other accidental causes?
I think they can, Your Honor, but that's not what happened here. What happened here is we had a determination, actually on May 12th, the day of the second fire, that this was an arson. And they called ATF. They told ATF, this is an arson. We've eliminated rekindle. We've eliminated all accidental causes. And they called ATF not to do an origin and cause investigation. They called a follow-up investigator. And that's the guy who looks for the culprit after it's been determined to be an arson.
Why does what they told or did not tell the ATF matter so long as the ATF ultimately did not find arson? In other words, was there any official or public finding that the cause was incendiary at the point when the ATF was called into the investigation?
Well, it depends on what you mean by official. Agent Kushner's report, which is in the record, said that it was an incendiary cause, that is arson. The Winnetka Fire Department's NFIRS report, although we don't have the original report, we have the changed reports, at least one of them identifies the fire as incendiary. So yes, there was an official determination that this was an arson. And they reached that determination by applying standards to McDonald that they did not apply in any other case. And that's by their own
the second part of this test is the no rational basis element.
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't you have to show a departure for the norm as part of that? So that leaves nothing for the first prong, seems to me.
Well, I think they certainly the...
You're not going to get in on that rational basis unless there's a departure from the norm, I don't think.
Well, I think that certainly they blend together. I mean, we would need to show, first of all, it's a factual issue whether they departed from the norm. And as you noted, obviously they say they didn't.
Yeah, well, they say the same thing here they said in every other case. That's why this is a rather interesting discussion, it seems to me. I mean, whether these other cases are adequate comparisons for this case is very questionable, I think.
Well, I don't think it is, Your Honor, and here's why. Their own expert admitted, and they admitted, that the differences between fires do not affect the application of these standards to the investigation. All fire investigations should proceed in the same manner, regardless of the differences in detail.
Well,
between they say
that's their position in this case.
Understood,
why is this
Your
case
Honor.
Any different from any other?
That's a jury question, though, whether in fact they did deviate in McDonald.
Well, there's got to be something for the jury to go on. There's got to be some evidence, I think.
Where in the record will we find evidence that while a fire investigation is underway, it is improper either to call the ATF into the investigation or to pursue arson as a possible cause of a fire unless and until all accidental causes had first been ruled out?
First of all, I believe that Winnetka's expert testified that until accidental causes have been eliminated, you really shouldn't start pursuing the arson line of inquiry. But beyond that, Your Honor, I don't think that's crucial to our case. The issue here is not whether it's proper to start thinking about arson, to start looking into the possibility of arson. The issue is, do you make the determination that it was an arson, with all the implications of that, including, in this case, a federal grand jury investigation,
well,
without following the standards?
Well, let me explain to you why it is extraordinarily important. I need to know what precedents would have made it clear to the individual defendants that they were violating Mr. McDonald's constitutional rights by bringing ATF into the investigation before rekindle was definitely ruled out as a potential cause of fire.
And you're talking obviously about qualified immunity, Your
yes.
Honor. Well, first of all, as the district court found, the standards that apply to class of one cases were well established in 1999 when this incident occurred. This court had already decided Esmail and a number of other cases. Second, as we discussed in our reply brief, the case of Levenstein versus Salavsky, obviously it's not a fire case, But I don't think it needs to be. You don't have to have a case that's identical in all its facts. If you did, you'd never overcome a qualified immunity defense. In that case, the facts basically were that there was a charge and happened to be sexual harassment in that case, and the defendants, without rational basis and for an improper motive, abandoned their normal investigative approach to such charges for the purpose of singling out the plaintiff in that case, a medical school professor, because they were concerned about his threatened investigation into financial improprieties. That was decided in 1998. So we believe that the standard... Was there a case that said you can't call ATF under these circumstances? No, of course not. But that's not required to establish that the constitutional right at issue was something that they should have been aware of at the relevant time.
So you think that one case was enough to put the fire department on notice?
Well, I think that case combined with this court's prior class of one case certainly was enough. And of course, Your Honor, as you well know, you don't have to show that, you know, Chief Culpart or any individual member of or any individual defendant actually read the case and knew about it. The inquiry assumes that they're familiar with the relevant constitutional precedent. Assuming that familiarity, what would a reasonable officer in their position believe? We think that case is enough, Your Honor.
Let me take you a little bit of, away from this, because if we eliminate Solberg's email, what evidence is there in the record that establishes any animus?
First of all, obviously, as we explained in our reply brief, we believe that Solberg's email is admissible, and the district court did not rule to the contrary. But putting that email to one side, we like the email because it puts sort of in one place a number of key facts. But you get that information from other parts of the record that have not been objected to. Chief Culpart testified in his deposition that on the night of the May 12th fire, Mr. McDonald came up to him and made comments that suggested to the chief that Mr. McDonald thought the fire might be a rekindle. In other words, that the May 10 fire had not been properly extinguished. Mr. McDonald testified about that same conversation. He gave basically the same account, and he said he also mentioned to Chief Culpart, "I know this might be embarrassing, so this is just between us." Again, indicating, I think, supporting the notion that comes through in the email that there was a need to save face, that there was concern about what the impact would be on the defendants if this fire proved to be a rekindle. Also, all of the investigators, since they all claim that they eliminated rekindle as a cause, they all obviously, and several of them testified to this effect, that the thought occurred to them that it might be a rekindle. The Chief Culpart testified to that effect. So I think you get all of the pieces that are in that email from other sources that have not been objected to. Also, I would add that ATF agent Glowski testified to the same effect that Solberg had reported that conversation to him in essentially the same terms that appear in the email.
Going back to the equal protection, why don't you have to show the evidence in some other case, the evidence that it wasn't a non-arson cause and the evidence that it was, and compare it with the evidence in this case in order to have an equal protection case?
Because, Your Honor,
and send it to a jury if you want to on that basis, but it seems to me just to say, well, they said they followed the rules in all these other cases. It doesn't prove very much.
Because, Your Honor, the violation here was not that they declared this fire an arson and they didn't declare some other fire an arson. The violation was the procedure that they used in this case was different than the procedure
they used. Well,
that's their
claim, but they certainly don't admit it.
Well, but that's the factual issue, Your Honor. That's the factual issue here. We have evidence, and it's detailed in the briefs, that they did not eliminate rekindle as a cause. It's undisputed that there was no affirmative evidence that the fire...
How do we know in these other cases that somebody didn't claim the same thing you're claiming? You know, we just have the fire department's eventual ruling as to what they thought it was, but the owner could have thought it was something entirely different, as they do in this case. So I don't see where you've proven anything by telling us what the fire department thought about other cases.
Well, again, Your Honor, it's not what the fire department thought about other cases. It's how the fire department investigated the other cases.
Well, we don't know anything about that.
Well, sure we do, Your Honor. They told us how they investigated it. They said in every case, this is what we do.
Well, they say the same thing here. Well, go ahead. Answer the question.
Well, and again, Your Honor, I think that's a factual issue for the jury. We presented...
Well, what is the issue for the jury?
The issue is, did the defendants in this case follow the standards that they admitted they applied in every other case? And that's the issue that we believe should
not
have been resolved.
Well, that might give you a negligence case, but I'm not sure it gives you a constitutional law case under the Equal Protection Clause.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that with no rational basis for the difference in treatment and the evidence of illegitimate animus, that does make it a constitutional case. I see that I'm into my last minute, so I'd reserve what I have left. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We asked you a lot of questions. Mr. Safer, good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Ron Safer. I am here representing the Winnetka defendants. Mary Welsh will represent the fire marshal. Ms. Welsh will address qualified immunity and issues particular to Agent Kushner, and I will address the remaining issues. Just as Judge Cudahy just said, what the plaintiff in this case seeks to do is collapse the two prongs of the equal protection into one. What he says is, I do not have to point to somebody who is similarly situated. I just have to prove some deviation from the norm.
What is your understanding of the investigative norms that the plaintiff is relying on? Are accidental causes supposed to be ruled out first during the investigation before incendiary causes are pursued, or does this apply sort of only to final public findings? And for heaven's sakes, what in the record will clear that up?
There is nothing in the record that shows a norm about any of that. The only thing that the record is crystal clear on is each fire is different and each fire investigation is different. There is no statutory norm. There is no regulatory norm. There is no handbook. What there is a guide to investigations, NFPA number 921, which, by the way, plaintiff's expert says, and I quote, it is a guide. It is not a code. It is not a standard. It is merely a guide. There are no norms as to that.
And, of course, the guide says you rule out all these various possible causes of the fire. And then if you rule everything else out, it might be arson. What's the reason that procedure wasn't followed, or that guide wasn't followed here?
That procedure was followed here, Your Honor. That procedure of marching through these accidental causes, of course, they can't all be done right at the scene, but that's exactly what was done. As Mr. Trella just said, they considered rekindle. That's his argument. That's what the Saulberg email proves, if it was admissible, that they considered it. That is fully proper, and they did rule it out. In their view, it was not a rekindle. They said that to ATF. They had done that. They did the analysis. That plaintiff argues they didn't do it right or doesn't agree is not the issue.
Because the guide doesn't spell out each and every permutation of how an investigation should be conducted. True?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. And if you look at at other fire investigations, for example, it was the Lori Dan situation, which Winnetka investigated, where you had gasoline filling up the steps. Was there an elimination of all other accidental causes? Absolutely not. In other investigations, they say, aha, look at this one. They say we ruled out other causes. Doesn't say how they did it. Exactly the same as in this case. So those that process was followed in this case, but of course, even if it were not, that does not make an equal protection claim. Deviation from a norm does not mean differential treatment. If Mr. Trella did not answer the court's question, but the answer to the court's question is clear. There is, under their reading of the law, a class of one equal protection claim every time the government would deviate from a norm. If there was a zoning board that said, we have a procedure that we follow in all cases, and But, and we call witnesses in all cases, and somebody comes up and says, I want a zoning variance, and they say, you know, sorry, we're not giving it to you, and they don't follow that procedure. They would say that was an equal protection violation. But that he wants to build a nuclear power plant on his house may be why they didn't call it. You don't know. You have to look, was he similarly situated first? Deviation from a norm is not enough. That does not equal differential treatment. They have never, ever pointed out what it is to whom he is similarly situated that was treated differently. The second prong is equally wrong. First of all, a couple of misstatements about the record. They did not tell ATF, this is an arson, bang, we have reached our final determination.
No, but they didn't tell them that rekindle had not yet been ruled out either.
Well, in their mind, rekindle had been ruled out, Your Honor, and what they said was this was a potential arson. Investigate. They didn't impanel a grand jury. They didn't say he's indicted. They said we're investigating, and that you should investigate this. To do otherwise is to totally chill an investigator from calling in independent resources to examine the evidence of during an investigation. The Kushner report, by the way, comes 10 days after the referral, not before the referral. The second prompt, was it irrational to call in ATF? That, you know, clearly the answer is no. You had two fires, two full days apart. In the interim, before the second fire, there is a dispute between the homeowner and his insurer as to the extent of the damage caused by the first fire. The homeowner says it's a total loss. The insurer disagrees. The hours before, and they learn of this, by the way, on the day they make the referral that they ask ATF to come look at this. The day they make that referral, they learn that hours before the second fire erupted, there was an adamant disagreement between Mr. McDonald and his insurance agent over whether or not this was a total loss. Mr. McDonald was in the house hours before the second fire erupted. There was a great blazer mysteriously there. No reason for it to be there in the driveway less than an hour before the fire erupted. There is finally the suddenness and vehemence of the second fire. All of those factors said, investigate. That's all they did. They called ATF and said, look around. What is irrational is plaintiff's theory. Plaintiff's theory is that Culpert and Smith somehow, they don't explain how, somehow knew that this was a rekindle. That they somehow knew that it was their incompetence that caused this rekindle, and then they said, let's get an independent federal agency to come in and investigate this and examine what we did. That is irrational. That theory has no support in the evidence. What the answer to the question of was, if you eliminate the Solberg email, which must be eliminated because it has no foundation, what is the evidence of any vindictiveness? The answer is zero. McDonald and Culpert both testified to that conversation. Both of them said that McDonald said nothing that intimated that Winnetka was in fault. He said nothing to intimate that Winnetka was responsible. He said nothing to indicate that this was a rekindle. That they were on all fours on that. There was nothing to indicate that these men were embarrassed. They did absolutely the right thing, and their lives have been turned upside down. Today is the day to end that, Your Honors. This judgment should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you.
Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Ms. Walsh.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of the State Fire Marshal Investigator, Mitchell Kushner. Your Honor, I'm addressing three issues today. One is whether a reasonable jury could find from this evidence that Mr. Kushner in particular violated the plaintiff's rights under the Class of One Equal Protection Theory, and whether all reasonable investigators, the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis, would have understood that this conduct was a Class of One violation. The two other issues, which I'll rely on the brief, are the jurisdiction over the state law claim, and we'll also rely on our motion with regard to striking the statement of facts or dismissing the appeal for violations of Rule 28.
But Mr. McDonald said in his reply brief that there was no sovereign immunity problem with respect to the state law claim, and you might want to respond to that point.
Your Honor, I mean, I know he says that, but I believe that the Turner case and so on show that when state officials are sued for state torts, that the sovereign, they can only be sued in the Court of Claims. I mean, that's the Sovereign Immunity Act. They can't be sued in federal court for claims like that. And we'll rely on our brief for that point. With regard to the deviation from the norm, again, as Mr. Zafer said, you have to show not just, I mean, the Equal Protection Clause does not protect solely against unequal treatment. You have to show unequal treatment of equals. And here, all the plaintiff hasn't shown that. There's simply no evidence of similarly situated people. And what we're talking about in terms of similarly situated fires are not every fire in Winnetka, but fires like this that have suspicious circumstances. As Mr. Zafer talked about, the dispute with the insurance agent 1 hour before the call, all kinds of people at the house the day of the fire, nobody knowing, no investigator, no fire person, fire department personnel from any place said that they were familiar with the notion that a rekindle could occur 2 days later. But also in particular, Kushner testified in great detail, and we go over this painstakingly in the brief, as to the fact that he did in fact follow what these norms are, these guidelines. He in fact first figured out what the origin was. It was on the west wall, and he had been told by Hernandez, and this is undisputed, what Hernandez told Kushner is undisputed. Hernandez doesn't say anywhere that he told Kushner something different, but he saw flames coming from the south nook. Also, Kushner was told, he testifies in an unrebutted way, that he was told that the fire had not reached that wall. So he concluded, rightly so, that the origin was at that wall. And if the origin was at that wall, he had to rule out rekindle because he had been told that there was no fire there. So he eliminated rekindle in an affirmative way. And he also told, and then he also eliminated utilities and so on later when he had verified that. And he also affirmatively stated, without any contrary evidence, that he saw ashes at the site of the west wall. And so there is affirmative evidence. He says, I saw these ashes. Those told me that someone put combustibles there. And this was, in fact, Mullooly, the ATF investigator, said, 10 months later, when he went to a totally cleaned up site, I can't rule out an arson. That could have happened here. I can't rule it out. And this tells you that there is not no rational basis for this finding of for the finding of arson. And again, the preliminary finding on May 12th or May 13th was there, and the referral was on May 17th. After, again, information about the insurance company dispute with Mr. McDonald about the extent of the loss. And only 10 days after the referral was the final decision by Mr. Kushner that, looking at all the evidence in front of him, from everything he knew and was told, that the cause was arson. And he only told the ATF this is a possible arson. He did not, as Mr. Sato correctly said, he did not say, this is an arson, get on it, we're positive. What he says is, this is a possible arson. Those are his words. We don't think it's a rekindle, but you should probably look into this. And in fact, Mr. Glowski, the ATF follow-up investigator, talked to a cause and origin investigator of his own, Mr. Marochka, and said, look at what they're telling me. Look at the photographs from the May 10th fire. Look at the photographs from the May 12th fire. Look at what everything is, you know, what Kushner's telling us. What do you think? And the ATF investigator, Marochka, said, I think we should go ahead. I don't see any reason not to. And Mr. Glowski also testified he didn't rely only on Mr. Kushner saying it was a possible arson. Mr. Glowski said, I relied on a couple of things. I relied on Marochka, my own cause and origin investigator. I relied on the insurance company investigator, who also told me that he thought it was an arson. And I talked to Kushner. So the ATF investigation proceeded not based solely on Mr. Kushner's statement, this is a possible arson, but it proceeded after consideration by both Glowski and the ATF investigator Glowski and the ATF investigator Marochka. I see my time is up, but with one final word as to qualified immunity. There is simply no case, as Judge Rovner pointed out during plaintiff's argument, there's really no case that would have told Mr. Kushner or any investigator that they had to conclude that referring a case like this when there are suspicious circumstances, such as particularly the insurance phone call, that this kind before making a final determination of arson would be a class of one equal protection violation. So we ask that this court affirm so that there's no chilling effect to investigations like this one.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Mr. Trana, I know your time is up, but we're going to give you another 2 minutes.
Your Honor, first to address exactly what ATF was told. ATF was told this was an arson. We have determined that this is an arson. There was no preliminary about it. I refer the court to the Glowski deposition, pages 16, 55 to 56, 67 to 69. Kushner testified to the same effect at page 254 of his deposition. They were also ATF was also told, we've eliminated a rekindle. This was not a rekindle. Again, the Glowski deposition at 27 to 28, 31 to 32, 93 to 94, and 98 all make that point.
And you know what? If we had a situation where that was all that was told to ATF, and then ATF was told, here's the investigation, here's the conclusion, just issue your report, we might be in a different world, but that's not what happened.
Well, Your Honor, that is what happened here.
No, because the ATF then conducted their investigation.
Well, that's correct. But ATF, and the testimony on this is clear from the ATF people, they relied on Winnetka's and Kushner's determination that this was arson. The ATF investigator, was the guy who finds the culprit, not the guy who determines what happened. Now, admittedly, ATF certainly was free to go back in, and thank goodness they ultimately did go back in at McDonald's insistence, or not insistence, but ability to persuade them, and they concluded that they could not rule out rekindle. I think it's also worth noting what ATF was not told. ATF was not told that this house was loaded with cellulose insulation, was not told that cellulose had burned and smoldered in the first fire, wasn't told about the hot spot that they had to come back and extinguish, wasn't told that Kushner's dog, the trained dog, had not found any evidence of accelerants. Agent Glowski testified to all of this, that he didn't know any of this until McDonald's investigator called it to his attention. Now, going back to the differential treatment point, the district court's opinion states that repeats the norms, and by the way, Your Honor, Judge Rovner, addressing your earlier question to me, the district court's opinion indicates, if doubt exists about the cause of a fire, an investigator must rule out all possibilities of accidental fire before drawing conclusions, forming opinions, or proceeding with an arson investigation and trying to determine an incendiary cause. So that goes to the question you had asked me earlier. And the judge, I see that I'm out, but just one final point.
Sure.
The judge went on to find, when Solberg and Roeder have investigated a residential structural fire in Winnetka, They have eliminated all accidental causes and have found affirmative evidence before they made an incendiary determination. Kushner followed these same procedures. This isn't about a negligent investigation, Your Honor, which is the way Mr. Schaefer tried to make it seem. It's about deviating, in this case, for illegitimate reasons and with no rational basis, from the standards they apply to everybody else. We would ask that this be reversed.
I'm rather surprised looking at these earlier cases that there were this many findings of arson in Winnetka. Apparently half the houses in Winnetka have been arson.
Makes both of us who live on the North Shore kind of nervous, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, one and all.